Home isn't just a place, it's a state of mind. Like curling up in a comfy chair as you watch the world go by.
Good afternoon.
Which is why at Delta, our people do our best to make you feel at home long before you get there. Delta, keep climbing.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Hello to all. It's time for another episode of the award-winning The Show About Stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. I'm your host, Stephen Davis. Joining me on this episode are two marvelous guests who happen to be film producers, directors, and actors. First, I want to introduce my friend who have previously been a guest, Mr. Kenya Cagle, whose new horror film he directed, and it has just been released. We will talk about that film later. My second guest is the great actor who starred in such films as Car Wash, Commando, Predator, American Gigolo, and Menace to Society. He's directed numerous episodes of television series such as Cagney and Lacey, Dallas, Hill Street Blues, Miami Vice, Hunter, and he's directed films such as Rage in Harlem and Sister Act 2. I am honored to have Mr. Bill Duke. Welcome to both of you all, and thank you for being on my show today. How are you all doing today?
Doing well. Fantastic.
Now, Bill, you're out in California?
Yes, sir.
How are you doing out there?
Doing well. The weather's beautiful. Every day I get up, I'm blessed, and so I have no complaints, sir.
Okay. And Kenya, where are you at?
I'm in Harlem, New York. It's still beautiful. It's a little chilly, but I have no complaints also.
And that's our other connection that I had told you about before, Bill, because I was born in Harlem also. But I moved to the center of the universe. It became the center of the universe when I moved here. Good old Brooklyn, New York. I generally start off my show, and even though, Kenya, we talked about your background and your past, I do want to talk about your past and bring up those cells of the memories from long ago, Bill. Bill, where were you born at?
Because you've never heard of Poughkeepsie, New York.
Poughkeepsie. Oh. And how long were you there for?
I lived there until I was like, I think maybe early 20s.
Early 20s. And how was it living in that area during that time? Not that I'm saying it was such a long time ago.
It was beautiful in a lot of ways. There was racism, because we're talking about the 1940s, 50s, 60s. But there were some very kind white folks and some crazy black folks and good black, crazy white folks, the way the country was. But it was a town of opportunity also. Vassar College, Dutchess Community College, the Culinary Institute of America, where all the great chefs come out of that area. So it's a very interesting area.
When you first of all, tell me about your parents, your mother and your father.
My father came from West Point, Mississippi. He came from Orange, Virginia. My mother from West Point, Mississippi, they faced things only that we can, it was during a time of great segregation in the South, but they did not let that stop them. And my father moved to New York State, worked three jobs, and came home and ate dinner. My mother worked two jobs and then cleaning houses and came and cleaned her own house and made dinner. And they were people who never gave up, never stopped, and never let you as a child use an excuse for doing anything. I remember one time, I tell this story all the time, that my parents gave my sister and I a whooping, it's called a spanking, for disobeying something they said. And so we got angry, we ran away. We were so stupid, we ran away upstairs in the attic. And we took two sandwiches. And so we hid in the attic and we took our dog Spidey with us. So my parents came home. Ivan and Dookie, where are you? We didn't say nothing. My mother started crying and they were upset. And unfortunately, Spidey the dog barked. And they heard the dog bark. They came up to the attic. First, they brought my sister down. Then they brought me down. And then they brought Spidey down. First, they beat me. Then they beat my sister. And then they beat Spidey's like,
and he's the one who squealed. When you said your father had three jobs, I just had to think of the Wayans brothers. And you only got two jobs?
That's right.
How was it going to elementary school? And what elementary school did you go to?
I think it was Hyde Park Elementary School. And it was great in a way, but I'll tell you, my first day in class in elementary school, all of us were asked to stand up and say our names. And I stood up and said my name, because I was the only Black person in the class. And so they said, stand up. I said, what's your name? I said, Bill Duke. Okay. Lunchtime, sitting at a table by myself, and the white kids at another table were laughing. And one of the white boys stood up and said, what is your name? And he said, Bill Nigger. And they all laughed.
Oh, that's terrible. That's terrible. Did you have any emotional scars during that particular time in terms of going to school? I'm sure you had some.
That day, when I came home, I went to the bathroom, got in the bathtub, and put some Clorox in the bathtub with water, tried to wash the black off of my skin.
Oh.
And I was going to drink it. My mother came in the bathroom just at the right time, and she snatched the bottle out of my hand and took me out of the bathroom.
Kenya, we talked about it before, but you went to school here in Brooklyn, right?
Yes, I did. I attended PS5 in public school, which is on Ralph Avenue and Ralph and Halsey. And then I attended junior high school 35, Stephen Decatur, right there. So I was a Bed-Stuy guy, born in Bed-Stuy, raised in Bed-Stuy. And then after junior high school, I did a year at Franklin K. Lane, and then I took the test for Performing Arts High School, where I went for the majority of my high school years. So the first time I really ever got out of Brooklyn was when I went to Franklin K. Lane, which was on that edge, borderline Queens, Brooklyn thing. And then when I went to Performing Arts to 10 in Manhattan, I remember getting off the train and looking at the buildings, and they were so high and so tall. I was scared that some of those buildings were going to fall. I was looking and I was walking and just bumping into people. And they really must have thought I was kidding, but it was just like an amazing sight. I loved it. And not only that, I also remember going in the train stations and looking at the wide gaps in the train stations and having fear of that. So those were like little, wow, how could people do this every day? And where did these buildings come from? And then after a while, you got used to it, started to make sense, and went through the same hassling and stuff that we do. But in Brooklyn, I was born on Lexington Avenue, right there, Lexington, Marcy, Nostrand, and Marcy. It was really a terrible place, terrible time. All my memories of Lexington Avenue, I think they start before I was even in junior high school or public school, All my memories there are basically negative memories. I have memories of cut glass and seeing people argue. And also I had a traumatic incident when I was young over there. Bill, I don't even know if you know about this incident. I was playing with two of my cousins outside, and there was a woman who was, she was arguing with her old man. He had been gone for a few days and was seeing somebody else. And she had prepared a garbage can with bricks and stuff for him. And he got to the building, to the edge of the building, and she dropped these cans trying to hit him, and they hit me. Yeah, and I had awakened in the hospital. And I remember when I woke up, I remember seeing the white sheet. I thought I had died, and I remember calling out to my grandmother. So Lexington Avenue over there, that wasn't fun. I remember the starving days. It just wasn't a fun place. I go through there now, and now all the tenements is down.
Different.
Yeah, it's totally different. It's a great place.
It's gentrified.
Yeah, just gentrified, but it's not a great place to grow up in.
As a matter of fact, I live about 5 to 10 blocks away from there. So
fantastic. It's a different place.
It's a different place these days. The houses are going for, some of the houses are going for $2 million, $3 million.
Yes, yes.
So it has definitely changed. Now, Bill, you went to high school where?
Roosevelt High School.
That was in New Hyde Park?
Yes.
That was interesting. Like Roosevelt High in New Hyde Park. I wonder why. Wasn't Franklin Roosevelt living in New Hyde Park?
Franklin Delano Roosevelt was one of the most famous people in the country at that time. And I think he did live in Hyde Park. And it was an interesting time at that moment.
And what was your experience while you were in high school?
It was very great because it was still prejudice, but there was also some great young white men who embraced me, Dick Check and other people, and we started a band, sang together, and it was like we went to parties together, and it was a really good time for me in high school.
What was the band called?
Oh, I don't remember. A long time ago.
It was. Did you play any sports?
Yes, I did. And they expected me to play sports. I played first basketball, horrible basketball player. And then I started playing football until one day I was playing defensive tackle. And I was pretty good at it until one day the other team hit me what they call high and low.
Uh-huh.
And they knocked me out.
Oh.
Took me out to film the stretcher. I didn't play football after that.
I have a friend, Carlton Brown, who played football in high school in Mississippi. And you know how Mississippi was about their football. So he was, even though it was, I think, segregated at the time, he played football. He was about 6'2", 6'3", and he's about 280 pounds. And he was a big guy. He was offensive line. And then he went to Princeton University and they expected him to play football. I guess that's why they really went after him. Although I think got in on an academic scholarship, I think. But when he got to Princeton, he said, I ain't playing no football. And he joined the fencing team. Now, one of the interesting things that I really wanted to talk about, because both of y'all had the similar experiences in terms of your education going from high school. A lot of people go from high school and then they, at that time, begin acting or doing thing and they forewent college. But both of you all went to college and you went beyond college. Tell me about your experience first at Boston University. And I know there's a story there because I read it.
If I don't remember, remind me, okay?
Okay.
Boston University, how can I say? It was a positive experience in a lot of ways because it was in Boston. And BU was a great school at that time.
It's not anymore?
No, I'm not saying it's not, but I'm saying...
I just had to add that in.
But it was a place where I found so many things. And so I remember all of them, but remind me of the one you're thinking of.
The big one. The room and board.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that story.
This actually happened at Dutchess Community College, I think. What you're talking about.
Yes, it happened at Dutchess Community College, but it helped you in terms of Boston University, right?
Yes, I was going to BU. I'd gotten the scholarship there and doing well, but I didn't have money for room and board. So I came back to Poughkeepsie. And I was a racist at the time because it's like, you know, I hated white people because I just saw all the things that were happening there, blah, blah, blah. So I was confused about my racism because two things happened to me. One, when I was in high school, there was an English teacher named Dean Walker. And I used to be a writer because I was dark-skinned and tall and couldn't express myself well. So I wrote in the journal all my feelings and poems and stuff. But I would write my journal also in Ms. Walker's English class. She had told me several times, do not do that. And so one day I was there and I was writing my journal. She said, I told you to not write in my class, but to pay attention to the board. I looked at it. She took my journal. I said, Ms. Walker, she said, shut up. I hated her, hated her. At the end of the semester, she comes back and I go back to class and she says to me, and I'm getting ready to leave, she says, Duke, stay here. I said, Ms. Walker, where you want? She says, stay here. All the other students leave the room. She hands me my journal back. And then she hands me another book. She had taken my poems and entered them into the National Poetry Contest. And some of my poems got in that book.
Wow. Fantastic, fantastic.
But that kind of confused my racism a little bit.
I'm sure it did.
The second thing that confused my racism was, as you said, I got to Boston University, but I didn't have money for room and board, I got a scholarship. And so I got the scholarship and I came back to Poughkeepsie. I was going to just stay in Poughkeepsie for a year and work and get enough money for room and board. So the president of Dutch Community College, Dr. Hall, heard about that. So I went to visit a friend at Dutchess. He said, and I saw Dr. Hall in the hallway. He said, Duke, come to my office. Said, Dr. Hall, I have no time. He says, come to my office. Come to his office. So he was a very stern guy. Not many people liked him. And so he says, how are you doing at BU? So I'm doing good, but I'm coming back to Poughkeepsie for a year and work because I need money from my room and board. He says, no, you're not. I said, Dr. Hall, I don't have time to discuss. He says, wait. He reaches into his vest pocket, takes out an envelope. He hands it to me. He says, open. I'm a racist at this time again. I can't stand all of this. He opened the envelope, and it was a check that paid for my room and board for the rest of the time I was at BU.
Wow. That was a great story. I that's a great story. It's a great story on many levels. Humanity and the fact that he recognized the greatness in you to do that.
Yes.
Particularly since you were Black.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's a great story. Kenya, how was your college?
My college was fun. I went to Empire State, and then after I finished Empire State, I went to Metropolitan. But just the whole thing on that racism thing, while I was junior high school, I was probably racist. I heard all horrible, wicked things that white folk had done to black. Now, I haven't experienced it myself, but I heard about it. So I was pretty angry. I was pretty angry with white folk. And then when I went to performing arts high school, I went into this place that had everybody, blacks, whites, Latinos, gays, everything. I'm like, oh my gosh. I went there and I started slowly but surely, the shell stopped breaking down. Mm-hmm. Friends of, or whether they're black, white, whether they're gay, everybody was just good people. I had thought that this entire group of folk was horrible, but I started to see that it's just wonderful. People are wonderful. Once we get past all that colorism and the politics and all that kind of stuff, you go for the heart. Imagine Bill is where he is today. Bill's a legend in the industry. But what would have happened if that teacher wasn't there who gave him that check?
Yeah.
What if they were as horrible as we said they were? Right? We thought they were. Would we have continued to go to the school? Would we have said, like a lot of brothers do, later for it, I'm not doing this. I'm not going to school. I don't need that. Or looking for fast ways or money or excuses. It's meeting people, getting out there, getting beyond. I know some people in Bed-Stuy, right on Halsey Street, who are still on Halsey Street, who was on Halsey Street 40, 50 years ago when I was a kid on Halsey Street. And everything they do still is in Bed-Stuy, even though it has gentrified, they're still there. They go to the store in Bed-Stuy. They go to movies. Everything they do is right there. They haven't seen the world. They haven't seen. My older brother, Alfonso, he had cars and money. He was an unlicensed pharmaceuticalist. But he had never traveled outside of Brooklyn. Ever in his car. I remember we went someplace to a dealer or something to get his car checked out. And the dealer was saying, he said, man, this car, you need to take it on the highway, man. You need to let it go. So you had this car for years. He said, you don't have hardly any mileage. He would drive the car from one side of Brooklyn to the other. He went from Monroe Street to Atlantic Avenue. That was about the furthest he would go with his car. And so was everybody in his circle. That was the world. The world was that small little.
I have two things to say to that. Number one, Kenya, I live on Halsey Street now.
Oh. Hallelujah.
And number two, I was fortunate enough for me to, my father was military. So my first experience in grade school was at an integrated school in Japan. And then moved back to New York. And eventually I ended up, because my father was stationed at Fort Bragg, so it was the beginning of the 60s. And I went to school on the base at Fort Bragg, so that was integrated. And then when I came off, my father was due to go overseas and he couldn't take the family. We moved off post. And the high school that I went to, there were 20 of us, 20, 25 of us that integrated that high school. There were 20 blacks, 20, 25 blacks, and about 1,500 whites in the South during segregation time. How we got together as a people, particularly the males, was two things. Sex. Talking about sex and sports. That was the great thing that brought us together and decided, not so bad after all. So now, after you, Bill, you left Boston University, did you go directly to graduate school or you did other things in between?
No, I had a great mentor by the name of Lloyd Richards, one of the first Black directors on Broadway. He directed Raising the Sun.
I remember Lloyd.
Great man. He became my mentor. And I followed him to NYU School of the Arts. And it was an incredible education. He was a great master. He gave back. And so Lloyd also worked with the Negro Ensemble Company. and got my first job with the New Ensemble Company called Lloyd. And so I'll never forget him, and I'll always say his name because he was a great man.
Did you know Woody King?
Oh, yes, Woody King Jr., yeah.
Woody's my buddy.
Yeah, Woody King is responsible for a lot of the history of Black theater.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that's my buddy, Woody King. Kenya, after you came out of school, what did you do?
I did a few things. I actually started working for the city of New York. I became a social worker.
Is that because your parents said you need to get a city job?
Of course it was. Of course it was. I was doing the struggling artist thing. Remember? No, you need to. So I went to the city of New York. I became a social worker. I was probably one of the worst. I really took care of my clients and did really great job in terms of being a social worker because I used to get special cases. There was a program called Family Preservation Therapists. So I was one of the therapists. And as a worker, what we would do, we'd go into a home. A normal worker, caseworker, they're going to a home and they look at a risk. And if there's a risk in the home, they will remove the children from the home. Therapists, we go into a home, we look into the home, and if there's a risk, we remove the risk, right? If we realize that the children are at risk because of addiction, or educational neglect, or some other obstacle, it's our job within a certain amount of time to fix it, get rid of that, and make the home safe and safe environment for the kids. And that even if that meant that every day we had to take crack-addicted mamas to drug treatment programs, if we have to do intense domestic violence counseling, if we had to make sure that the environment was right, or if we had to make sure that the parents were able to get enough food and clothing. So our job was pretty demanding. It was pretty tough. As therapists, family preservation therapists, we would spend 20, 30, 40 weeks in a home, and we were on call 24/7. So I got to see a lot of things, hear a lot of things. But as time went on, I became worn out. And the reason I said I was probably became one of the worst therapists is because after a while, I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy because I always had the dream of being a filmmaker, being an actor, being a director. That's all I ever wanted to do. But being a young man, a kid, I didn't want to do anything else. Everything else was just work. It was tough. I used to call Bill all the time and talk to Bill, and Bill would say, Kenya, it's not what you do, it's what you're doing it for. And then life became fun and exciting when I realized, wait a minute, I can do them both.
So did that experience help you in terms of your film career?
Absolutely. Not only has it helped me during my film career, I'm using it all the time. I'm able to stand human behavior in a way that I'm able to put into my films. I'm able to understand why certain people react a certain way. I'm starting to understand what the elements are and what things happen to people who's been abused, people who's been shat upon, people who's been just, most times we don't do things and people don't act a certain way for no reason. A lot of times there's reasons underneath. You never know where a person come from just by looking at them. You can't tell by their clothes. You can't tell by their speech patterns. But when you get into their heads and you find out what happened to in their life, the trust and betrayal, those doors all broken down. And normally when they were broken down and when they were stripped away, it was by someone they loved and trust. And that's why it's no secret that when you're living a one family, a one parent household, your risk of going to jail and failing is a lot greater than someone who's been living and raised in a two family household. That's no secret, you're right? And then there's no secret that if you're involved with someone who's been abused, that their life may not be as consistent as you would expect it to be. That drugs and alcohol and promiscuity, that all goes with having had some type of traumatic experience in your life that you haven't been able to resolve, right? Because nobody ever grow up and say, hey, look, I want to be a drug addict when I get older. Nobody would say, hey, I want to grow up and abuse my wife and my child, my dog, right? Nobody ever did. But everything we've been through affects us today. So it helps me in terms of understanding my characters, having real situations. The stories of the workers is just incredible stories. They've been through a lot. And at the same time, caseworkers, especially in the city of New York, caseworkers would spend all their time working on the case. But once one thing happens that is not correct, the city, the state, the government jumps on the worker. And it's always been that way. So it was an experience. It was an experience, but I kept my dream. What kept me going was my dream. My dream of being a writer, producer, filmmaker, that kept me going. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to stand the job and stay on the job.
Now, Bill, did you perform on stage first or in film?
Stage.
And tell us about the first film that you did. And I always ask this question because I think that this gets to the character of people. When you walked out on that stage the first time, how did you feel?
Well, the first time you walk on a stage, you feel so vulnerable because you're being judged by hundreds of people, and you feel, I hope I don't blow this. A lot of insecurities come into play. But if you've rehearsed enough and you prepared enough, you overcome them. But it is, I always tell people that being on a stage as an actor is much more difficult than being in a film, because on stage, you don't get no take 1, 2, or 3.
You don't say, hold it, wait a minute, let me do that over again.
No, one take, that's it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not saying film is less, but it's a whole different reality.
Do you remember the first play that you did? I'm jogging your memory, aren't I?
The first major play was on Broadway with the great Melvin Van Peebles called Ain't Supposed to Die a Natural Death.
Okay.
Wonderful. And I was like a newbie compared to a lot of the older actors that were in the play. But my part, I was standing in the wings and watched the stage, those better actors to learn. It was an incredible experience.
And that propelled you to go forward more. Now, when you had your first applause.
You work hard, and you're just trying to get through it and do the best you can do. But when other people appreciate what you've done, and showing it in terms of applause, it's reassuring. It gives you a certain emotional, mental confidence.
It seems to me that particularly the stage, but you get the same thing in movies also, or film, is that for Black folks, that has been an engine for social change. Am I speaking the right thing in terms of that?
Say it again, please.
I said, it seems to me that particularly stage over the years, but film also, have been a major engine for social change in terms of Black folk.
It's most certainly impacted us in terms of our self-images. It gives a voice to the voiceless, and it's very important. It was a social media of our time. And so to see someone on stage that reminds you of yourself and going through experiences that remind you of what you're going through is powerful. It gives you validity. Whether they fail or succeed, that has an impact, but it's not as important as actual recognition. you exist outside of your own head. You know what I'm saying? You exist. You have validity.
How do you feel about that?
I think if a 1 minute commercial can sell you a product, then a 1 hour or a 2 hour film can sell your lifestyle. I think film, television, radio, theater, I think they're really important in terms of messaging. I think they're really important in terms of getting facts out there and getting differences of opinions out there, especially in this environment now where you have textbooks that describe slavery as a peculiar institution that benefited both Blacks and whites, right? When you have leaders in government saying, no one ever complained about slavery in 1776, right? Those kinds of crazy statements that's being made by folk whose ancestors were not affected on the negative end, right? So it's going to be up to the artists, the poets, the singers. It's up to us to really pass down a true legacy and history of who we are. It's up to us to put up positive images. Now, I'm not saying that negative images and all that stuff don't count, but I'm saying that as artists, we are responsible for the culture of life. We are responsible. Our paintings have to get out there. Our books have to get out there. Our poems have to get out there. And if we're doing it for any other reasons than what's inside of us and what we live in, if we're doing it for other reasons other than being true artists and not true to ourselves, then we're sort of seeing the point. Because art, you can have a film and you can have art, right? You can have a book and you have art. It's different. There's commercial, there's art. Right. And when you're free to do your art, you're free to write your book. You got to write what's inside of you. And it's going to affect the masses. It's going to affect whatever circle, whatever niche you have, it's going to affect it. So it's really important that we as artists are conscious of who we are, how we act, and what we do. Because there's a child watching that we don't even realize it's in the wings. All right.
Now, Bill, when you did Car Wash, was that one of the first films that you did?
Yes.
When you did Car Wash, you just previously talked about when you were growing up, your hatred in terms of white folk. Did you channel that into that role?
Oh, yes.
I didn't have it to came through really clear.
I didn't have to go far. All those emotions and that pain and anger, all of those things in that character. And okay. The great Ivan Dixon, the scene we did at the end, he was a great actor, but my character had a moment of expressing the pain of young men of that time. Yeah, we were angry. We were also hurting. Very seldom that's why Michael Schultz is so brilliant. He enables the audience to see that not just angry Black men, but what made him angry. Does that make any sense?
Yes. We'll be right back.
Home isn't just a place. It's a state of mind. Like curling up in a comfy chair while it's cold outside. With a warm drink or maybe even a wine in hand. As you watch the world go by outside your window.
Short rib.
Good afternoon, this is your captain speaking.
Which is why at Delta, our people do our best to make you feel at home.
Refill?
Long before you get there. Delta, keep climbing.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
I did want to tell you, one of the persons that I've been talking to is Leon Pinckney. As a matter of fact, because I'm the president of an organization called A Soulful Heart, memorializing George Floyd, Inc., and I'm the manager of one of the uncles of George Floyd. Right after we did a concert here in New York in May that I invited you to, Kenya, that you couldn't make, he invited the Floyd family to Newark. We went the next day because there's a George Floyd statue in front of City Hall in Newark. So I took the Floyd family over to City Hall with the mayor to take a photo in front of the statue. It was great. But I thought about him when I knew that you were going to come on. I says, oh, look at this. I'm meeting everybody from Car Wash. Now, tell me, in terms of the other roles that you chose, I would imagine from your statue that you chose the roles, even though they were great roles, that there was a certain image that you had that you wanted to make sure. And by the way, one of my favorite episodes, your role in Kojak, and I think you, Rosie Greer?
Yes.
That was one. I would always look for that episode.
It was fun.
Now, did you choose your roles? Some people just take roles just because they need money. You seem to me to be a person that was very conscious of your image and the roles that you chose.
Yes, I respect and appreciate those people who take certain roles because they got to feed their families.
Yeah.
And I've been very fortunate in the TV role with the Rosie Greer and Kojak. I think I played a pimp.
Yep.
I feed my family. But
Thank you so much.
I've been very selective in the roles I've chosen. I've been very fortunate. From Car Wash to other films I've been in, Commando to Predator to Mr. Society. I really enjoyed those characters. The people, they weren't just caricatures, but they had some substance in them also. So that's what I love.
Kenya, did you first act before you got into directing?
Yeah, I was a child actor. I worked with, one thing is, when I went to junior high school, my talent was art. I was a great painter and drew. By the time I was 12 or 13, I was selling paintings and stuff like that. And when I went to junior high school, 35, it was sectioned by your talent. And if you had talent, they put you in classes where they had instructors to increase your talent. So my talent was art. And so I wound up in T2, which was a talent class for artists. But I wanted to be with the actors, and I had never acted before. The actors were in the SP classes, right? So I found out what time they were have, what time the classes were for the acting. And instead of me going to science in the evenings, I went to the drama class. It was months before the instructor, the drama teacher, realized I wasn't registered in his class. And I had already been cast for a major role in the school production. And I had to negotiate with the principal and everybody because I wasn't taking science. So of course I was failing science. They told me I had to drop the drama and go to science. I told them if I drop drama, I'm not going to science. I didn't care. They said, you won't graduate. I said, I don't care. I'm going to the drama. And so we worked it out. I would do science after school. I would study. I'd get all the notes. When I had that deal, I was scoring the highest marks in science in the whole class because I didn't want to lose the drama class. And I did our first production. We did Pearly, where I played the white guy. I played old Captain Kachapi because we had no white people in the school. I was with some beautiful actors. Kenny Nixon, who is now one of the top civil rights lawyers in Buffalo County. He played opposite me. I played with a guy named Daryl Hoggett. And then that summer, and this is the thing, that summer, I got to meet and work with this great director who had become a legend in the industry, Bill. And we worked together. We just clicked. We worked together. And next thing I know, I was writing. Bill allowed me to co-write with him. We did Dreams. And we performed under Robert Hooks and some of the great Douglas Turner Award. We performed Dreams at the Negro Ensemble Company on the old St. Mark's, the first building they had. You remember that, Bill?
Yes.
I was a member at 13 of the Negro Ensemble Company. You can write that in a dream. And that's my first paid job was as an actor. I was with Bill Duke. Tyrone Williams was also there. Cold Chillin' Records, who would go on to create Cold Chillin' with Big Daddy Kane and all the rest of those guys. That was Ty. His intern was a young man named Sean Combs. So I was around greatness. And that's why it was easy to believe that I can be great, because I met Bill and I met Garrett Morris and I met Dick Williams and I met Cleveland Ford. I met the top guys in the industry. You're around them, you can't help but some of it have to rub off if you're paying attention. And I'm going to tell you something. See, I got Bill. See, he's in California, so he can't get me now. Bill is a taskmaster. He does not. You can make one mistake, but you can't make the same mistake twice.
One of my greatest thrills was I was a chairman of Coppin State University, their foundation, and the drama department was doing Raisin in the Sun. And I got to bring Woody King and Douglas Ward Turner to the college to speak to the students. Wow. And that was a great experience. Now, I want to talk about directing. And then, Kenya, I want you to talk about a little bit about the new film. Yes, now, Bill, you moved into directing and you directed some amazing film and television series. How did that happen?
Not going to leave this story, but I always wanted to direct. But I went to the directing stage and I got a couple of awards. And I wanted to direct the film, but I could never get a job. They would say, we'll do your second, we'll get you first. So I applied for Knox Landing. I liked the show at the time. They said, no. And then one day, one of the producers called me and says, come on in, David Jacobs wants to talk to you. So he was the producer of Knox Landing. Sit down, and the meeting was 3 minutes. I said, it's just a formality. I went back to my agent and said, it's not going to happen. A week later, my agent calls me and says, David Jacobs wants you to direct an episode of Knox Landing. I said, what? So I was in pre-production. And my last day of pre-production, the producer comes in and he says, great pre-production, but we all knew you were going to be great from your reel. I said, reel? What reel? He said, the reel that you sent. I said, no, I just have a film I did, a short film. He says, wait a minute. He goes into David Jacobs' office. David Jacobs had mixed my box up with somebody else's.
Life is fortuitous, isn't it?
That's how I got my first job. God is good. So I can say.
And I see that you really enjoyed. Which do you enjoy doing more, directing or acting?
That's a hard one. I love directing because directing gives me more control.
I knew you were going to say that. It was going to come up my lips, and I said, shut up, let him talk.
You can actually create messages and themes, and you can entertain people. I call it edutainment. You can also make them feel something. That's why I love directing. I like acting too, but directing I love.
Such a great career. I do thank you. I know you said that you had to be out here at 11 and it's one more minute. So I wanted you to be able to end it with whatever you want to say.
I want to say, one, God bless you so much for this wonderful program. Thank Kenya also. And I want to thank God for enabling me to have the career I've had, to be alive today and to still be here at 79 years old. And it's a blessing every day. So every day I'm here, it's a blessing. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being on. We'll continue on, Kenya, but you can go ahead and
love you. Thank you so much, man. Thank you for everything you've done for me and all the other artists and young people who can follow behind you in your footsteps, man. We hope to keep making you proud.
Love you. Thank you.
Kenya?
Yes, sir.
Let's, first of all, let's talk about your directing.
Yes, sir.
Now, we have a connection in terms of your directing also, don't we?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
I was actually looking at some of the scripts from Illuminations just yesterday.
Hallelujah. Yes, that was a great experience. Working with Illuminations was a lot of fun. We had great guests on it. We had great Julian Hill working with us, the great late Julian Hill. That was a lot of fun. That was really great to have on my resume, and I thank you for hiring me for that.
Audience, I just want you to know that we had a show called Illuminations here in New York, and Kenya was the first director of that, and actually was talking about it last night, and I was saying, oh, I remember shooting the first episodes in your apartment.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. We come a long way. We come a long way. We mentioned Halsey Street. My dream of being a filmmaker and my dream of being in the arts entertainment was something I had with me from childhood. My younger brother, Leon, and I, we used to get up maybe 5 and 6 years old. I used to wake him up every morning and say, hey, man, we got to perform for the wooden people in the wall. And we really believed there were wooden people in the wall watching us. And we would get up and perform. We were right there on Lexington Avenue, get out of bed. We're singing. We had a little show we would do called Big Blood God, which was about these two vampires. We would sing and dance for them. And I really believed it was happening. And then by the time I got to Halsey Street, the other part of Halsey Street, when I was over there, I had gotten a hold of a Super 8 movie camera. Super 8 non-sound, non-sync movie camera. And I would take the kids on Halsey Street, and we're still in junior high school and high school, and we would shoot films right there. And these films, there were no sound, there was non-sync films. We would cut them out, and we would have premieres at my house. And when we had the premieres, it would be crowded. Folk, we would have kids from all over the place. And this is without the formal training. Right, so I was doing the films without the formal training, but I knew what I wanted inside. And like I said, and then by the time I wound up working at the Negro Ensemble Company and all these great actors and actresses, and our show was being followed by Daughters of the Mock when it first came out. It was just powerful experiences. And like I said, it wasn't hard to believe in greatness. It wasn't hard to believe in doing what I had to do. And see, but one thing that I didn't catch hold of, I didn't catch that Hollywood thing. I didn't catch the thing where you wait for somebody else to hire you. I didn't catch the thing someone else is going to feed you or your family. I went to Empire State College and learned in Empire State College independent studies. They gave you a contract. You got a contract, you had to tell them what you were going to do after a certain amount of time. And if you did not do it, you would not pass that class. Right. And you had to go and you had to get and you had to learn. That was the education. That was the beginning of getting greatness as a director. And the reason I use the word greatness, I'm not telling myself this is great, but I'm telling myself as somebody that's striving every day for greatness and striving to become great in this field, in this industry. As you probably know, my last film, My King, which is still showing on Tubi, my last film won over 70 awards worldwide around the country in different festivals. That's mind-blowing to somebody like me.
That segues into your present film.
Yes. Currently, I have a film, this only part of it is showing, but it's a film called Sinapple. And Sinapple is the story of a man who's so obsessed with a woman that he decides to get a love spell on her. He's going to dabble into black magic to get her to love him. The spell succeeds, But problems start to arise when she still has in her heart a true love who she could never get rid of, even with a black magic spell on her. It's a great story. We had a lot of fun shooting. It stars Christopher Clayton and Naza Cop. We shot it and took about a year or so to shoot it. Probably my second longest film to shoot, but we shot from Las Vegas to New York. We have different scenes at different parts of the season. And it's called Sin Apple because it takes place in Sin City and it takes place in the Big Apple.
Okay. So how can people get it?
All they have to do is you go to Tubi, you download Tubi, and this is one of the great things about Tubi. I got to tell you too, Stephen, you may want to check out Tubi yourself. But one of the great things about Tubi is actually owned by Fox. So they have the finances. And Tubi is the place where independence is finding the most success in a whole bunch of areas. Commercially, financially, it's a place to be. It's a place to get your film. Tubi has a Black cinema section. A Black cinema section where independent artists, Black artists or artists that have done something that deal with us, they have a section called Black Cinema. And their films come from all over the world. And it's an opportunity for our people to see these films. And it's been really successful because you have to understand. Remember the old Fox?
Yes.
The old Fox was built on rock and living color and Black shows because we're a great niche audience. And when the old Fox became stable and they started making money, what happened was that's when the studios really started investing in the old Fox. But see, what happens though is once a certain amount start coming in, then they slowly got rid of the Black shows.
Yeah, very clearly.
Then Netflix used the same method. Netflix was a place where independent films were always, if you want a great independent, you go to Netflix, and a bunch of Black independent films were there. Netflix started getting mainstream type of films and the studios and folks start coming. And remember, a lot of times they avoided Netflix, but all of a sudden Netflix started getting eyes and eyeballs and making money. And guess what? The Black films started getting canceled from Netflix. The studio films started coming in and the independent producers were slowly but surely, the true independents was slowly but surely pushed out. They're the independent films on Netflix, but they ain't independent films.
True.
It ain't guys from Halsey Street putting in their own money, getting their own cast, creating films. The studio comes in, move them out. Now, like I said, Tubi is a great place for independents, but Tubi is also having that thing is starting to happen.
And transition.
You got Tubi, which was filled with, especially Black cinema. Black cinema was filled with a bunch of independents. The independents are still there, but guess what? The studios are now there. The studio films are there, and they take it on. And you have to understand, if you're home, and this is the greatest thing about Tubi, and why I hope that it stays the way it is, because all of our people can't afford Netflix and Amazon and all those places. But we can afford Tubi. Tubi is free. And we're on Tubi. So because Tubi is free and we're on Tubi, our people and just people in general is going to give an independent title with no stars a chance. They say, oh, that's a good story. They're not looking for Denzel and all those guys. They're like, oh, man, that's a good story. Let me look at it. Let me see who this is. And so then our people, the independents, we start to get little niches into the industry. And then what happens is the industry finds out, wait a minute, you have independent films. I know some, it's not my film, but there's some independent films making 100,000 or more quarterly with no stars, right? They're doing this quarterly. They have these films, man, with these beautiful women being action heroes. And it's us talking about stuff that is not talked about in the mainstream, right? And it's not all negative. We're bankers and doctors and lawyers and chiefs and, right? That can happen on a Tubi. That can't happen on a regular. But the studios start to come. They start to come in. And of course, if you have a choice and it's a Saturday night and you have a guy from Halsey Street or you have Denzel, you're going to probably watch the Denzel film. But guess what? Still right now, there's not enough established film, studio films there where you're going to spend all your time on studio films. You're going to take a chance with a Sin Apple or My King. And independents, us independents, we get a chance. We're actually able to eat. That's the thing. We are still starving artists, but we get to eat. And a lot of us, high five figures is one thing, but you know, there's a lot of us who are getting into the mid six figures. And that's not something that happens. I've been on Amazon Prime. A lot of my films have been on Amazon Prime for a long time. I've never got the five figures or the six figures, never even had the opportunity. None of that happens. And the thing is, of course, you already know I've done studio films and stuff too, but the independent films is where we can talk. It's where we can make our statements, where we can have our film say what we want. The film Sin Apple, even it's a horror film. It's a horror film. It's a thriller. Sin Apple, there's an undercurrent of Sin Apple is belief in God and Christ. There's an undercurrent there. And that undercurrent is not a message that's acceptable in mainstream. We were picked up, this film, Sin Apple, was picked up by one of the other bigger streaming services. And I don't really want to say whom, but we actually mentioned them earlier. But it's picked up. It was there. And then they saw the content. They want you mentioning Christ or God, not in a positive way. We could say everything else. Get rid of that. And I'm like, no. See, because I'm an independent. I didn't eat off my films for a long time. I don't do my films to eat off my films. I eat off my films.
I understand fully what you mean.
But I eat off my films now. But I didn't get here trying to eat off my films. I got here trying to do films. There's a difference. I never had dreams of being famous and all that kind of stuff. I had dreams of making projects. I had films of creating the art. That's my dream. And there was times I made great money, there's times where I made no money. But I don't make films to make money. I make films because I'm a writer, I'm a director, I'm a producer, I'm an actor. And so that goes out there. And commercially, that's different than I don't have to follow the rules. And I never was a rules person. If I know the boundaries of what the rules is, I'm always going to dip my toe on the other side, just on purpose. That's why I say I was one of the worst employees in the city of New York. I gave my people a rough time, and I was backed by Local 371 and DC 37, and I knew all the rules, and I would go right to the edge on purpose. Why? I just like breaking the rules sometimes. So as a filmmaker, I can go and break the rules. I don't have to shoot any other way than what I decide is going to be. I don't have to write any other way but what I have to write. When you're in the studio and when you're doing studio films, you're doing films for other people, if they say, you know, that they want a spaceship to come down in the middle of your block party scene and take up some of your people, you got to put it in. Because even though you're the artist, the person who's paying you, they're going to tell you what songs to sing, what dances to do. Independently, nobody tells me how to dance. Nobody tells me how to sing. I do it myself. And I say what I want in my films. I can't say to somebody, you're a terrible, dirty, mo flow. I can't say that, but my films can. Nat Turner can say it. Another character can say it. Sin Apple, scene in Sin Apple where one of the women, a woman is talking to she calls him a bum. We call him a homeless person. She's like, you're a bum. Why should I listen to you? And he says to her, if you're not saved, get saved. If you are saved, stay saved and get saved some more. And that's just a line in the film. And I couldn't believe it. That was the other big streaming service. Hey, man, you need to cut that out. Me? So I don't cut up my films for nobody else except for myself. Sometimes there's things in there that may be offensive. If I want to keep it in, if it's part of the art and part of what I want to say, it's going to stay in. Melvin Van Peebles tell this story about when he did Sweet Sweetback. When he did Sweet Sweetback, the studios called him and told him they didn't like the ending. They read the script. They didn't like the ending. They told him they wanted a different ending. Melvin said, and they said, Melvin, if you want this thing to be distributed, you're going to have to give us that ending. And Melvin made a deal with him. He said, I tell you what, I'm going to shoot both endings. And when I give you the film, it'll have both endings in it. You choose the ending. So they said, okay, great. And Melvin, not being a fool, Melvin shot the film and shot it with his ending. He sent it. He said, they were looking through. He said, they're looking for the footage. They said, where's the other ending? He said, what other ending? Like, what other ending? You don't argue with them. You're still... Then it was the next move was up to them. You spent a bunch of money. What, you're not going to show the film now? And of course, Sweet Sweetback became the beginning film of the blaxploitation era because they saw that we support our own. See, that whole thing about us not supporting our own is not true. You look at the black cinema on Tubi. It's not just my film, but there's a whole bunch of great films on Tubi from us. Black cinema. We can't get on Netflix. They don't want us on Netflix unless we're stars, unless we're in Bill's category. Let's win Eddie's category. They don't want us. They don't want us if we're new. They don't want us if we're not known. They don't want us if we're artistic. Not anymore. But we made them. The independents make them. We come along with the small grocery stores in the neighborhood. If your neighborhoods will be lost without bodegas serve their purpose. I know I could go on and on, man.
I do thank you so much for, number one, being on the show again. I appreciate it. And I appreciate your bringing Bill Duke on. It was wonderful to have both of you all on, and particularly to show folk the importance of education, even in the art. You have to know how to do what to do. You also have to know how to deal with those other folks you're talking about. So I do appreciate that.
Yes, sir. And
thank you.
Thank you.
That's it. For having me. That's it. The show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Thank you. And next week, we'll have another wonderful episode. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
Home isn't just a place. It's a state of mind. Like curling up in a comfy chair as you watch the world go by.
Good afternoon.
Which is why at Delta, our people do our best to make you feel at home long before you get there. Delta, keep climbing.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.